Welcome to Straight Talk with Wine Spectator, a podcast from the world's most widely read wine magazine. Here on Straight Talk, we introduce you to some of the most intriguing and accomplished stars of the wine and service industries, and we'll also catch you up on the wine world's biggest news stories, trends, and upcoming events.
You can't make a great wine from good fruit. You have to start with premium fruit, and our job as winemakers is to not lose the quality along the way, and I do think that the more winemakers can get involved in the vineyard, the better the wines will be.
I'm James Molesworth, Senior Editor and Special Projects Director for Wine Spectator, and today our guest is Natalie Winkler, the winemaker and viticulturalist at Napa's family-owned Salvestrin Winery. Natalie is part of an up-and-coming new breed of California wine pro, someone who doesn't specialize in either winemaking or vineyard management, but rather in both. It's kind of an old-world, old-school model that's becoming the new school in Napa and Sonoma these days. Since joining Salvestrin in 2017, Natalie has really helped raise the profile of this interesting and historic multi-generational family property, and I'll be talking to her about that and much, much more in just a bit. We'll also have Wine Spectator Senior Editor for News Mitch Frank on the program. He's going to catch us up on some startling wine crimes. But first, it's time to check in with my wingman, podcast director Rob Taylor.
Hello, James. We've missed you here in New York, and now you're turning around and leaving us again?
True. I came back to do laundry, and I'm heading out again, this time to Bordeaux. It's springtime, which is the en primeur season, which handily serves as an annual reminder that we're the only major wine publication whose reviews are based on blind tastings, without the influence of knowing the producer or the price of the wine. And well, you can't do that when you're visiting a chateau and the owner is standing there pouring the wine for you. Now, this en primeur season, this is all done by the Bordelais as they prepare to offer their wines to the trade. They're offering their most recent vintage, which will be 2023. The wines are still in barrels. So I go over and I taste informally. I get a read on the vintage at its early stage. I'll report back on that in the near future. But there's really no reason for consumers to be buying 2023 Bordeaux at this time. Whether or not they give you a great price out on it or not is not going to really help the situation. The wines that are actually in bottle and on retail shelves right now, that's where me and my fellow editors like to put their focus for our readers.
And while our listeners and I anxiously await your return with word from the MADOC, we have a pretty excellent cover story to check out on newsstands now and at winespectator.com. Our May 31st issue features a story all about the very prestigious, very in-demand, very expensive Chardonnays and Pinot Noirs of Burgundy's Jean-Claude Ramonet. Our very own senior editor Bruce Anderson visited Ramonet and his daughter at their domain in Burgundy to get the scoop, and probably more than a few tastes as well. James, you've been reviewing California Pinot Noir for some time now. I know how much you're into the Rhone. Are you a Burgundy guy too?
Absolutely. You know, my wine career started in a specialty wine shop in the West Village that sold only Burgundies at the time. And that has stuck with me forever. It was very formative for me to taste those wines so often in my early career. And I love a good Burgundy to this day. Though, as you know, the region's price point has pretty much jumped the shark.
Yeah, you will find a lot of Burgundy on my top 15 most expensive wines of all time feature at winespectator.com. It's a pretty fun look at some extreme wine spending.
Did Ramonet make that list, Rob?
James, you've got to read the story to find out. But yes, Ramonet earns a mention. And of course, I have one last very important programming note. Wine Spectator's Grand Tour Super Tasting of more than 200 plus wines rated 90 points or higher is coming to New Orleans this coming week on April 26th, followed by stops in Las Vegas May 4th and Denver May 11th. For more details and to buy tickets, visit grandtour.winespectator.com.
Thanks, Rob, for catching us up on all that. Let's get to my interview now, though, with Salvestrin's winemaker, Natalie Winkler.
Our next guest is Natalie Winkler, who has worked harvests in Spain, Australia, Bordeaux, and counts Danny Roland and David Ramey among her mentors. She's currently the winemaker and viticulturalist for Salvestrin Winery, located in St. Helena. It's a multiple-generation family-owned winery producing Cabernet, Sauvignon Blanc, Zinfandel, and more. And the winery's 2018 bottle of Dr. Crane Vineyard earned a spot in our annual top 10 in 2021. Natalie Winkler, welcome to Straight Talk. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
So your first time on the podcast, welcome. The first question we always ask is, what was your wine epiphany? Where were you and what were you doing and what were you tasting when you said, I need to get into wine?
Well, I had already kind of dipped my toe in the water. I was working part-time at a wine bar during my university years at Oregon and Eugene, and it was Christmas Eve. I did not go home for the holidays. And so I was alone at that point. And the shop manager said, you can take a bottle home. I chose a bottle of 2007 Patricia Green Pinot Noir.
Okay.
And I didn't really grow up with a wine background at all. Totally, you know, pretty rural upbringing in the outskirts of Kansas City. So I take this bottle home and pop the cork, and roommates are gone because it's, you know, winter break in Oregon and raining. And I just spent hours with this bottle and watched it kind of evolve over time. And it was the first time that I had tried a wine where it really kind of clicked, and I had the desire to know more about how it was actually made, how it was grown, what the techniques were. And I really was paying attention to the nuance and the texture of the wine as it opened up. And like I said, at that point, I was working at a place that had a pretty extensive bottle list and 30 wines by the glass. But that was the first wine where I really, it was kind of an aha moment.
So you're at the University of Oregon. You get a poli-sci degree, right?
And yes.
Hey, look, I got an anthropology degree. Look where we are now. But you get the wine bug, and you head off to Spain.
Yes.
What was the allure of Spain? And there, that's where you furthered your wine studies.
Yes. So I double majored in political science and Spanish, and you can probably guess which one has proved more useful today.
Yep.
But at that point, being fluent in Spanish opened up the door to be able to do a harvest abroad in Spain. And because we were importing a decent percentage of Spanish wines, my mentor put me in touch with distributors that we were sourcing from, and I was just basically created a CV that was translated and sent it off to a bunch of wineries. And Bodega Elias Mora answered and said, "You can come and work harvest." And once I got there and got dirty and sticky and realized the physicality of harvest, I just did a 180. And at that point, it was a lot easier to sign up for class than get an EU work permit, which mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever tried to work in the EU, but it's very tricky. I did it again later. And when you're a student and you're signing up for classes, it's a lot easier to kind of, that's a loophole to be able to work and also study at the same time.
Did you want to stay in Spain and work there? What brought you back to California?
Well, I wanted to come back to California. I kind of threw casted a wide net when I was ready to come home, and knowing that a lot of the world-class wines that are coming out of the United States are in the Sonoma-Napa area. That's just where I landed.
And when you were in Sonoma, were you working mostly with Pinot Noir and other things? Or
yes. So I worked with Bordeaux varietals, also Pinot Noir, did kind of a deep dive with Pinot at Westwood Wines. And that was where I met David Ramey as well. And he definitely is an encyclopedia of knowledge and is a mentor to this day. But we did Pinot Noir, Rhone varietals, and Chardonnay.
Did David make you write any papers? You know, we call him the professor.
No, but I read a lot of papers that he recommended. I think that being an eternal student is one of the things that keeps you evolving and growing as a farmer or a winemaker. I think that you have to keep asking yourself, like, is there a better way? Is there a more efficient way? And if your quality is the same or, in, you know, going up, I'm definitely one to tinker.
How much tinkering have you done at Selvestrin? You arrive at Selvestrin in 2017, mm-hmm. and this is a multi-generational family-owned winery, which I think it's a fascinating story. But sometimes not being in the family and working for a family-owned winery, maybe they don't give you a lot of room to play. I feel like at Selvestrin, they've given you a lot of room to play.
I worked directly with Rich Selvestrin, who was a winemaker prior and manages the vineyard, planted the vineyard. And to his credit, he is a wealth of knowledge, and he has done a really good job kind of humoring me in a very respectful but not full tilt support way, where he's like, okay, we can try these things, but let's try and like parse it down to a few trials at a time, mm-hmm. you know, analyze what's working, what's not, and move forward from there. Cause and it's good to have somebody that has that restraint. Cause if it was just me, it would just be a madhouse of experimentation and maybe not quite as much focus, like trying to do too much at once, where, you know, working with a generational family winery as well, you have to be more strategic about the changes that we do implement, because we don't have every new toy that, you know, in winemaking and viticulture.
Right.
So I think we work really well together because of that, because I'm always pushing to do more change and Rich is like begrudgingly coming along. But to his credit, he's remained very open-minded and has definitely adopted changes that we've done together.
Well, it's understandable. It's his family name on the label. He's the third generation. Set the stage for us. Where is Selvestrin? And give us a little bit of the history. When someone comes up to you and says, what is Selvestrin Winery? Give them the nickel tour.
Oh, absolutely. So We are just south of the town of Santa Elena, so it's right on Highway 29. And the Dr. Crane Vineyard was originally planted in 1859, so one of the first five sites ever planted in Napa. So from a historical perspective, like a very special place. The Salvestrans purchased the property in 1932 and have been growing grapes ever since. And the wine brand was launched in 1994. And so they were growers for a long time before they ever started making wine. And so the roots in estate-grown grapes is like really the kind of the jewel and the crown, so to speak. It's a very special place.
I look at you as a sort of new member of this generation that is following in the David Ramey's and the Paul Hobbs and those people, where winemaking and the vineyard were very separate in the 70s and 80s and even up through the 90s.
Yeah.
A lot of people in your position today are wearing those two titles. And really, I mean, every time I meet with you, we're in the vineyard.
Yeah.
We're not in the winery that much.
That's true. You know,
do you feel like you have a handle on one versus the other? Do they? I mean, it might seem simple on the surface that they go hand in hand, but not a lot of people are still quite getting that yet.
Right. And I wouldn't say it's necessarily common. It is becoming more common. I have a few peers that I would say are on that level of, you know, vineyard manager, viticulturist, and winemaker. I do think it's the key to wine quality, though. And I think that more and more winemakers are starting to see that that is the key to increasing quality. Like, you can't make a great wine from good fruit. You have to start with premium fruit. And our job as winemakers is to not lose the quality along the way. And I'm really liking this kind of trend that you're seeing where site specificity and site characteristics are the most important thing. I think that for me, that's refreshing to see the approach to winemaking. It's like more of a purist standpoint. I do think that the more time winemakers spend in the vineyard, the better your wines are going to be. And really having an intimate relationship with the farming is going to just help you be a better winemaker. Like going out and pruning, you know, with the crew. I've pruned with Rich's dad and with Rich. And, you know, every time we're out there, he's always correcting me, as does his dad. And it totally annoys me. But at the same time, like, that's how you learn. And no two people are going to prune exactly the same way. So it's like, oh, well, I did this because of this, this, and this. And then I can see, okay, I see where what you did there. So it's not necessarily like it's this way was right and that way was wrong. It's more like, what's your approach and what are your goals? You know, are you looking to craft and kind of look at the new position for that spur for the next, not next year, but the following year? So it's things like that. I do think that the more winemakers can get involved in the vineyard, the better the wines will be.
So you, when you come over from Sonoma, you've been working with small, as you said, wineries, focusing mostly on Pinot Noir, among other things. And you come to Napa, into a historic vineyard, Dr. Crane. Some of our readers are no doubt going to recognize that name from the Beckstoffer Dr. Crane. There's only four owners of Dr. Crane vines out there.
Right.
Now, is that moving up for a winemaker? I know Napa and Sonoma have this sort of friendly rivalry. I mean, what's it like coming from Sonoma Pinot to Napa Cabernet? Did you want to make Cabernet?
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, after the experience in Bordeaux, which almost got me fired, by the way, because, you know, the French harvest and the Pinot harvest are at the same time. I mean, we had just a lot of the Pinot in, but, you know, we weren't pressed out. Right. Yeah, I was very much on the chopping block. But for me, it was a bucket list item. And I really wanted to work in France, and particularly Bordeaux. But I do think that there are... I mean, is it moving up? I don't know. The thing that's crazy is that Napa and Sonoma don't even really talk to each other. Like, there's this invisible line. I mean, I live in Healdsburg and work in St. Helena, and I have plenty of friends on both sides, and nobody talks to each other. Either your network is in Sonoma, and that's where it is, or your network is in Napa, and that's where it is. So I don't know how to quite answer that question, but I do feel like having a background in Pinot Noir gives you more of a finesse touch when it comes to making Cabernet. And I think that has been instrumental in kind of, I don't want to say changing the style at Salvestrin, because they were always that way, balanced, but just that kind of approach to trying to capture elegance in that classic style versus like a ripe, really opulent style. I think that working with Pinot really gives you a respect for kind of that more restrained style, if you will.
Is it easier to make Cabernet than Pinot, or is it easier to farm Cabernet than Pinot, or is it?
It's definitely easier to farm Cabernet than Pinot. There's no question. Is it easier to make? You know, I've thought about this a lot. So the kind of two sides of the coin are Pinot is lighter. There's not as much tannin and color to quote unquote mask what might be a flaw or a perceived you know, something that's a little bit less desirable. Cabernet is bigger. It's more full bodied. It can handle more of whatever you throw at it. I think in the end, I think it's maybe easier to make a good Cabernet than it is to make a good Pinot, but it's actually very difficult to make an excellent Cabernet. But Pinot is also, I mean, it's, I don't know if winemaking wise, it's a completely different approach. And it comes down to the vineyard. I mean, it's not even, I don't even view it as necessarily like a winemaker skill. There's no winemaker that can perform magic and make a world-class Pinot or Cabernet from a site that's not going to give you the quality of fruit that you need to do so. I think it's actually, I view the winemaking process as fairly straightforward if you're farming correctly. I think the key is in the meticulous nature of viticulture and the sites that you're working with.
So you put more pressure on yourself and your vineyard work to get to the easier aspect in the winery.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've done a lot of vineyard work since you got there in 2017, including shifting to organic and some biodynamic principles at Selvestrin.
Correct.
What has that transition been like? Because I think a lot of people think you can just flip the switch, and it's not that easy.
No.
It's honorable to get off of conventional farming methods and try to go organic and or biodynamic or regenerative or holistic, whatever term you want to use.
Yeah.
But it's not easy.
No, it's not easy. I think one of the biggest lessons I've learned is it takes time. Like we were talking about, it's good that Rich wanted to go slow with the changes because that's actually how vines adapt better. So, you know, taking the vines off of herbicide first, off of conventional herbicide, and then second off of organic herbicide, you have to do that over a number of growing seasons. Because if you just pull the plug and the vines are used to, you know, a lot of chemical inputs, they go into stress mode, they start, you know, water stress, the canopy falls apart, and I've done it before, so I know that you can't move too fast. So I'd say you have to be really thoughtful about how you're going to do it. And we have changed a lot slowly over time. Now we're not using any herbicides. We're certified CCOF organic. We're using regenerative approaches to everything. So it's a slow, steady process. And I think that you also have to be realistic about the fact that your weed management budget will go up. It's going to. I can't sit here and say that it's going to be cheaper to manage your weeds. It's not going to. But you also have to be okay with like a little bit of vegetation growing. And I think there is a re-education component that's necessary for the consumer too, to say, okay, what does an organic vineyard look like? There might be some growth in the in row and there might be growth between the vines, and that's okay. It doesn't need to look like a totally manicured golf course. That's not how nature is supposed to look.
Napa's had up and down vintages, and both qualitatively and in terms of weather patterns and style. Does that accelerate the learning curve when you go from a classic year like 18 to something a little more forward like 19 and then wildfire 20, 21 looks great, 22 heat spike, 23 cool?
Yeah.
Does that help you learn? Or are you like, man, can't I just get two vintages in a row that are the same?
I would say you definitely learn more during challenging growing seasons and vintages as a farmer and winemaker than the easy years. I mean, it's almost like, I don't want to say you don't remember the easy years, but it's a little bit more of a blur in your mind because you're like, okay, how was that growing season? I mean, I don't really remember anything really significant happening, so it had to be pretty good. You know, I take notes, but the ones that actually stick out in your mind are the ones that are challenging, and you do learn more because you're pushed to learn more. So do I think that we're better adapted to make high-class premium wines today? I'm way better equipped to do that than I was in 2017. There's no doubt about it.
Well, I'm looking forward to the 2023s from Selvestrin, as well as a lot of your colleagues in Napa Valley. I thought it was a vintage that played out really, really nicely at the end.
It's amazing.
It's early. I don't do hype, but it's looking like a good one.
We're excited about it.
Natalie Winkler from an Oregon duck working in a wine bar, traipsing around Spain, Bordeaux, Australia, now settled down in Sonoma, and now settled down in Napa, making wine from the Dr. Crane Vineyard at the wonderful Selvestrin Winery with the Selvestrin family. Thanks for coming into Straight Talk.
Thank you for having me. It was delightful.
I love that interview, James. I got a little pang in my heart when Natalie mentioned that her aha wine moment was a Pinot Noir made by Patricia Green. She didn't get a lot of press, but we got such an outpouring of love for her when we reported her sudden passing in 2017. And that ended up being one of our most read stories of the year.
You know, those threads that connect folks in the wine world are ever present. And yes, thanks. That was a fun interview with Natalie, who, along with the Selvestrin family, has been very generous with their time. They've let me poke around the estate often. They even let me work the sorting table at harvest. I should note that she has now taken on a second job as well as Sylvestrin. She's going to be working at Michelle Schlumberger in Sonoma, and she's definitely got her work cut out there for trying to bring that project back to some renown. But now it's time for some news, and we're joined once again by our own Mitch Frank. Hello, Mitch.
Hey, Mitch.
Hey, guys. Yeah, Patricia Green's Pinots are some of my favorites. Beautiful wines.
As much as I'd like to talk Pinot, Mitch, we've got you here to talk about darker things. Wine crime. Can you get us up to speed on what's going on out there?
Yeah, a great wine has sentimental value, but it also has financial value, and that makes it a target for criminals. One of our most read stories in recent months was the theft of 80 bottles of wine worth almost $1.63 million from La Tour d'Argent. If you know that name, that is the legendary Parisian restaurant and Wine Spectator Grand Award winner. It's actually been around in one form or another since the 1500s, since the days of King Henri III. And located on the Seine, it enjoys a stupendous view of the river and Notre Dame Cathedral from its sixth-floor dining room. But for our readers, probably the treasure is down in the wine cellar, two floors underground, where the restaurant houses some 300,000 bottles, totaling an estimated $27 million. So they reported to the police that these wines went missing in January, but the theft, they're not sure when exactly it took place. So during the pandemic, the owners decided to begin a long-desired renovation. And at some point during the three-year repairs, someone walked out with more than six cases of wine, including several bottles of DRC. And the restaurant didn't realize the theft until they reopened and ran an inventory.
That's a hefty theft, 80 bottles.
You would think it's not easy to walk out with you know, more than six cases of wine under your arm. I'm guessing it took more than one trip.
This is more than just a Pink Panther.
Well, they had Superman doing those renovations.
Sadly, this is the second Grand Award-winning restaurant to get robbed in recent years. In October of 2021... a couple checked into a hotel in Spain that is home to El Atrio, another incredible wine cellar and restaurant. So late that night, the woman and the couple ordered room service, even though the kitchen was closed. So the night manager, after some complaining, went to the kitchen to make her a salad, and her accomplice snuck the keys to the wine cellar out from behind the front desk and grabbed 45 bottles of rare wine, including a vertical of Chateau de Kim going back to 1806, and dozens of bottles of DRC Montrachet.
How strong are these wine thieves?
They were videotaped carrying out two heavy, heavy duffel bags and a rather full backpack.
So unlike the La Tour d'Argent case, Mitch, these thieves at El Atrio were caught.
Yes, by border police in Croatia, no less. They were crossing into Montenegro at the time. They were taken back to Spain and convicted and sentenced to 4 years in prison. But as one of the defendants said, as they were sentenced, where's your proof? Where's the wine? The wines have not been found yet.
Hey, Mitch, could you bring us some good news next time?
I'll see what I can do, Rob. It's kind of my job to be the dark cloud.
Brutal. All right. Well, Mitch, I guess I have to say thanks for that, for getting us caught up. But man, we do need some good news on the next one.
Hey, but maybe we can see Mitch at the Grand Tour in New Orleans next week. Will you be there, Mitch?
I will happily be there. And if any Straight Talk listeners find me, I'll be the guy in the bow tie. Please say hello. Happy to give you my suggestions on wines to taste and some good winemakers to meet.
You heard it here, folks. Tell Mitch Frank that Straight Talk sent you and you will get his inside information at the Wine Spectator Grand Tour in New Orleans, April 26th.
And that's it for this episode of Wine Spectator's Straight Talk podcast. Be sure to come back next month for our interview with Patson Hall's James Hall, as well as a return visit from our beloved Dr. Vinny. In the meantime, if you've got wine questions, Dr. Vinny might have answers. You can email us at straighttalk@winespectator.com or just follow the links in the show notes. Lots of great stuff down there. If you like the show, give us a rating on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. And don't forget to follow Wine Spectator on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and X. Until next time, this is James Molesworth reminding you to always share when you drink the good stuff.